Welcome to the SMA News Today podcast, episode 52. I'm your host, Kevin Schaefer. Today on the show, we're doing something a little bit different. We're giving Michael a break this time, but I am here with one of my other coworkers, Luisa Palazzola. Luisa is one of our social media managers, and she is from Memphis, Tennessee. She does not have SMA, but she has another rare genetic condition, cystic fibrosis. Luisa, thanks for joining us today.
Hey, Kevin. Thank you for letting me join you. Thank you for collaborating with my idea.
Oh, absolutely. I think this is a great idea. And it'll be really cool because, I'll mention in a little bit, you know, we have Rare Disease Day coming up later this month. And, you know, for listeners out there who don't know, SMA News Today is one of many sites under the parent company BioNews Services, which is a network of rare disease websites. So I think this kind of collaboration is really cool, and it'll be really interesting to talk about your story and also like what you learned about SMA since like doing the work you do now. So I'm really excited.
Excited as well.
Absolutely. So to start off, Luisa, tell us just a little bit about your background. So first off, tell us what cystic fibrosis is for listeners out there who don't know, and also when you were diagnosed.
So cystic fibrosis is in some ways, and correct me if I'm wrong, is similar to SMA in the sense that it is a condition or a disease that you're born with. Your parents have to be carriers,
right,
of the mutation, of a mutation. And if both parents are carriers, there's a 1 in 4 chance or 25% chance that the child will be born with CF. So that is how you get CF, you know, it's inherited. But where it diverges from SMA is how it manifests in the body. With CF, because of the mutations that we have, the mutation types that we have, the transport of salt and water in and out of the cell, and mind you, I'm giving a very dumbed down version.
It's all good. Michael is way better at the SMA, the science of SMA than I am, so it's all good.
Okay. But so in the actual cell of somebody, the cells of somebody with CF, the transport of water and salt in and out of the cell doesn't happen appropriately or doesn't function normally. Because of that, the symptoms that manifest really are going to affect the organ systems that have ducts. So your lungs or your respiratory system, your GI system, and the reproductive system are going to be the big ones that are affected. And what happens is the mucus our body produces doesn't clear normally, and it becomes very thick and sticky. And so in the lungs, what happens is that thick, sticky mucus obstructs breathing. It also creates an environment for chronic bacterial infections, which happens to many people with CF. And that mucus also damages the lung. In the GI system, many different things can happen, but the most common and most, you know, CF cliche sort of thing is the essential enzymes that you need to break down vitamins A, D, E, and K don't ever get to the intestine from the pancreas because of those clogged ducts.
Right.
So a lot of patients with CF have issues with absorbing those vitamins, fat soluble vitamins, and therefore have issues gaining weight, and that can cause malnutrition altogether. And so those are the two really big things that happen with CF is the GI manifestation and the lung manifestation. But like I said, this disease affects every cell in the body. So every part of the body is affected one way or the other. But the most common way CF is seen clinically. And then, you know, as we get older or because of how you are as a person, people have experienced all sorts of symptoms. For me, well, hold on. How about you ask the next question?
Yeah, well, I was going to say, talk about when you were diagnosed, because like we turned, you know, it is a thing you're born with, but you were diagnosed a little bit into childhood, correct?
Yeah. So with CF, the majority of patients are diagnosed, if not at birth, very young in life.
Because right.
I think from my understanding, a lot of people have a lot of issues with malabsorption, and so that raises a lot of red flags. And of course, a lot of people probably do deal with a lot of respiratory issues early on. In my case, I was diagnosed at 9 years old, which is late. And the reason why I was diagnosed so late was because as a baby and as a young child, I always gained weight normally. I was always in, you know, like the 90th percentile. I was always a chubby baby. So there was never really any, you know, the key symptoms that they're looking at when, especially when I was younger, I'm 26. especially when I was younger, cystic fibrosis was always malnutrition, really, really terrible lung issues. I never had malnutrition. I had never had any issues gaining weight. So whenever I did develop any sort of cold, I mean, when I was younger, I did deal with frequent sinus infections, frequent coughs, and bronchitis. But CF was never looked at because of my ability to gain weight. It wasn't until I was 8 and 9 years old that I developed a reoccurring walking pneumonia, and I stopped eating because I was so sick. I was feeling so terrible. I remember the day that cystic fibrosis first entered my mind. I was 10 years old. I was at the end of third grade. I had missed, I think, probably a month of school minimum. And my parents, you know, I'd been in and out of my pediatric doctor's office so much that year. And I remember I had gotten an x-ray, and the radiologist actually came into my room. And both my parents were there. And I remember him telling my mom and my dad that this looks like cystic fibrosis. Mm-hmm. And I didn't really know what that meant at that moment, but I remember that conversation. And within a week, I had a sweat chloride test done, which is one of the ways to test for CF. They test the amount of salt inside of your sweat. It's actually... with CF, that's one of the most typical tests to be done. Of course, there's genetic paneling that can be done that are more precise. But the more basic one is testing your sweat. And I remember the way they did it then is they put diapers on both of my arms to make me sweat. And I think they use some electrodes to help provoke that. I couldn't tell you the technological background behind that.
Sure, sure.
But I just remember being 9 years old at the hospital, walking around with diapers wrapped around my arms.
Yeah, that's gotta be awkward.
I was really sick, so I don't think I cared.
Right.
But yeah, so I was diagnosed then, and you know, I think the test results came back a couple of weeks later. I really don't remember being told I have CF or really knowing what that was.
Sure.
I just remember there was one point within the year that I was diagnosed that I was sitting in the van with my mom and Destiny's Child, I'm a Survivor came on. And I asked my mom if I was a survivor and she told me no.
Great encouragement, Mom.
I don't think she meant that in the sense of defeat. I think she just meant that I think she associated with survivor with somebody who's about to die, and I don't think she ever thought that.
I'm not sure.
I need to ask her why she said that.
That makes for a funny story though, so regardless. Well, and that was what I was gonna ask you next too. So and it's something I talk about with people with SMA is you know, when you're growing up with a condition that is, you know, that you're born with, even though you were diagnosed a little bit later, you know, was the impact of your diagnosis pretty immediate or did it affect you more later on in life?
I wouldn't say it impacted me immediately.
Yeah.
A lot of things happened that year in my life. You know, I was diagnosed with CF. Because they knew I was getting sick and I was getting recurrent pneumonias, I was getting healthier. I started a new school that year. So I remember right after I was diagnosed or within the first couple of months, my mom and my dad took us to Mexico. I had gotten a lot healthier by then. I was getting the appropriate treatment. So the impact of the diagnosis wasn't as immediate. My life started returning to a normal sense of normal.
Sure.
It wasn't until I was probably in high school when I started having really severe issues with hemoptysis, which is coughing up blood from the lungs.
Okay.
That was when the impact of my diagnosis really started taking shape into my life. And I started recognizing how profound my diagnosis is.
No, definitely. And I think that's a common thing with SMA as well is you know, it's different when you're born from something with something because, you know, you and I work with a lot of people with various conditions and a lot of them get diagnosed later on in life. And the impact is pretty immediate because it totally is a life changer for them. With people like you and I and people with SMA, it's more like a gradual kind of evolution, you know, in terms of how it impacts us. So I can definitely relate to that because I mean, it was similar for me too. Like when, you know, when I was in high school, that was when it started to progress more. And I started to like deal with things that I hadn't dealt before. So yeah, I can totally relate to that.
And I think, well, I think there's an element. I was really young when I was diagnosed, and there's this element of growing up with your disease.
Yeah.
Even though, you know, for me, with my diagnosis, my mom took a very, we're going to deal with this head on sort of way. You know, sure. She immediately dove into all, my mom is an engineer. She's from Venezuela, and her mother actually was a tuberculosis nurse, like the head nurse for the tuberculosis unit in Venezuela. So my mom grew up with a lot of science related terms and with health being at the basis of not only health, but lung health being at the basis of her life. And so with my diagnosis, I know it probably scared her. My dad scared the heck out of them. But my mom kind of took it head on. She said, I think she immersed herself in all of the groups that were available at that time online. She wasn't happy with the pediatric clinic here in Memphis that treats CF. So she found a doctor here that had experience, and I would see him instead. And so my mom did a really phenomenal thing in terms of integrating it with my life. And, you know, like I said, she took us to, both my parents did, they took us to Mexico. Like, it was just something that was a part of who I was, but it wasn't going to dictate my life. And I think I grew up, you know, I mean, I grew up sick because, I mean, I had so many manifestations of CF without knowing I had CF. So I grew up aware of my body. And then I had the diagnosis. And then as I got older, I was never told that you can't do something because of CF, you know?
Okay. Yeah.
Never told that. My mom would encourage me to do whatever I wanted to do, you know, within the realms of not causing damage to myself, because we would get in huge fights over doing treatments and stuff. But the impact of my disease and the impact of my diagnosis really didn't start to scare me until I started coughing up blood, which was a very profound experience in itself to cough up. I was 13, 14 years old, coughing up cups of blood. And that's when I started questioning what I would or not in my head, even though I was coughing up tons of blood in my head, it was like, okay, I can potentially die. But at the same time, I was also thinking, how am I going to make it to my next goal? How am I going to make it to, what do I have to do?
Right. Right.
And that's how I've lived my life.
It's like those questions start popping up more as you're getting older and dealing with different realities.
Yeah. Those questions become more and more prevalent as you get older, for sure. And throughout high school, I coughed up a lot of blood. I had, you know, admissions twice a year, every year. I was having an embolization, which is a procedure that they do to cauterize the arteries that's bleeding in your lungs. I had that 4 times to stop the massive bleeding. I've had transfusions, and I had experienced the peak of that in high school and the beginning of college. But it wasn't really until I was 22 that I started really thinking, when is this going to change? You know, when is this?
Yeah.
That's when I started getting sick in terms of like lung function declining. And I've always missed out on things, but I think I really hit like a moment where I was like, I'm sick of missing out of all of this. I'm sick of being sick all the time. Yeah. So
no, for sure. It
affects me more as I got older.
Sure.
Especially emotionally and mentally.
Well, and on that note too, you know, with the emotional and mental effects, like one of the things we've discussed a lot just in conversations is that SMA is a mostly visible condition. Like, you know, I mean, granted, there are more mild cases, and we featured people on the podcast who have more mild cases of like type 3 or type 4. But for the most part, most people with SMA are either in wheelchairs or they have some visible disability. But, you know, what was the experience like for you with, like, especially as CF started to affect you more, but it's still a more invisible condition?
So I think I could approach that from 2 different angles.
Sure.
Because I think, well, on one hand, I myself had a hard time accepting that I was sick because I didn't have more visible manifestations.
Okay.
I think I spent a lot of my time throughout high school, throughout college, shaming myself whenever I got sick. Of course, one reason I was shaming myself is because I kept getting sick, and it really, really frustrated me. But another reason was that, like, I didn't look sick. Like, I felt sick, but I did. I remember whenever I had to write an email to one of my professors in college, it's like, I remember thinking to myself, I hope they don't see me at, like, you know, a cafe or something. Because I would go to a cafe if I felt well.
Sure, sure.
I didn't look sick, but I felt like shit or felt bad.
Right, right.
I had a lot of shame because I didn't have any visible manifestation. And I remember thinking, you know, I would get sick a lot with coughing up blood, but that wasn't the case all the time. And in a weird and kind of messed up way, I was in some ways grateful for coughing up blood because there was, like, physical evidence that I was actually sick. I think I got to the point at sometimes not even believing or validating myself because, you know, I spent so much time sick, I would question whether or not I felt bad. You know, was it legitimate for me to be feeling bad, you know, today? Like, I don't have a fever, and I only have a cough. So I had a lot of issues accepting that I was sick.
Sure.
Because I didn't look sick.
And it's interesting you say that too, of, like, you know, like, even the coughing up blood and everything was validation for yourself and mm-hmm. for, you know, professors and all that, because it's like you want to make sure that they believe you when, like, trying to, like, emphasize just how sick you are. And it's like that provides evidence. But yeah, it's just fascinating because it's like that's something that, like, I think as many people that say, or at least in my experience, I haven't had to deal with as much because, you know, anytime I get sick in school or whatever, you know, teachers were very understanding because it's like that aspect of me is very visible, you know? So it's really interesting to hear that.
Well, and that's what I wanted to mention. On the flip side is, like, on my side of things, I had a really difficult time accepting and validating that I was sick because I didn't look sick. You know, I couldn't show tangible proof that I was sick. All I could say was, like, I'm not feeling well. But on the flip side of that, the people who were surrounding me in high school, I had, for the most part, really incredible teachers. But I had three different teachers who really questioned the validity of me being sick. And, you know, were overall cruel by not giving me extensions or by telling my class things about me while I wasn't there. And it was, I think it was because of those sorts of moments and those attitudes towards somebody who is sick that really developed a sense of shame going into college and telling my professors that I was sick and me doubting myself and me being very worried that my professors were doubting me. When in reality, especially when I reflect on my time in college, my college career, I only had professors, and this may be just me, but I only had professors who went above and beyond. You know, they didn't need doctor's notes or anything like that. Although I did have, you know, I was registered with my disabilities office. These professors, I could have very well have said, I don't feel well, and they would have believed me. But I didn't believe that they were believing me.
Sure.
It was really messed up.
Well, it's probably because of those experiences you had in high school with some of the, like, lesser teachers. It's like you're worried. It's like, oh, is this really real? You know, to have that kind of support. That's
right. Yeah. And it took me a long time to accept that I had that support in college. You know, I had professors who cared about me. I mean, professors who would go out of their way to make sure that I got the education that I wanted. And I not only that, who were just kind to me. I don't think it hit me until my second to last semester of college. I graduated in 6 years. So
yeah.
And the reason why it took me so long was probably because I let myself slip into really big depressions because I didn't think any professor would believe that I was actually sick. But my second to last semester of college, I was finishing up my thesis, and my advisor was phenomenal with me. she gave me like a 3-month extension on my thesis. I mean, she let me cry in her office like various times. And I could not understand how she was accepting the fact that I was sick. Like, I just couldn't understand. Like, I just felt so much shame. And she was like telling me, don't worry about it. Like, and I feel like all of my professors were that way with me, but I just didn't see it. And I didn't want to see it because I was competing with a very unrealistic expectation of what studious meant and how college should be. And also like my trauma in terms of high school.
Sure. It's like all those experiences coming together and everything. Like,
mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, they were all culminating together.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Well, Louisa, one other thing I want to talk about too, before we get into kind of what you're doing now and with the, like what you do with SMA News Today, is so since we started working together, you know, and since I've known you, which has been since around like August 2018, I think, you know, yeah. You've always been an active member of the CF community, but was that always the case? Or, you know, did you have, you know, were there plenty of other interests you had growing up?
So yes and no. Growing up, especially like in high school, I kind of dabbled in a little bit of advocacy here and there. Okay. I joined the Family Partners Council at my children's hospital. In my nature, in the back of my mind, advocacy and being able to speak up for yourself in terms of clinics was something that I have always been passionate about. I mean, I remember being admitted in the hospital, always talking to my child life specialist about how I could be more engaged in allowing other patients. And I wasn't talking about just patients with CF, but I meant like, I guess I was talking about patients who were at the hospital, and how they can use their voices to advocate for themselves. And so they actually invited me to be part of, at that time it was, we had a teenage, like the teens, like Child Family Partner Council.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
And then I gradually progressed to the Family Partners Council, like for the hospital. And I was the first, and I'm the only patient who's on that council. So advocacy has always been there. It's always been there. In terms of the CF community, though, it's because I'm Venezuelan, advocacy unfolded and unraveled in terms of advocating for the CF population in Latin America.
Sure.
And finding ways to give them a voice, and or not even a voice, finding ways to help mitigate the inaccess to medicines in different parts of Latin America. So those were the two things that were always on my mind, was being able to speak for yourself in the hospital. And that was a general idea that I was very passionate about, and I still am. And then the second thing that was always in the back of my mind was, how do I get medicines? And it's still in the back of my mind. How do I get medicines to people who really need it in Latin America, people with CF? So that's kind of where my advocacy started. That was all high school.
Yeah.
And in college, you know, with college being, you know, my number one daily life routine, I kind of stepped away from that. But it was still there, and I would still write, and I wrote here and there, I think just like Facebook and stuff.
Sure.
And I was actually at that point really starting to write about my mental health and be open with my mental health on Facebook, that I was invited to write a blog post for a cystic fibrosis organization called the CF Lifestyle Organization. And they provide grants for people with CF to participate in exercise sort of like programs and things like that. So anyways, they invited me to write for them. And that's when my voice got a little bit more active in the CF community.
Sure.
As I started writing more. And eventually I wrote to Brad Dell, who's our coworker. And I said, I was actually applying to jobs in general. I had graduated within that year. It was 2017. Then I was applying to jobs and I was really sick. I was like the sickest I had ever been. And I was on IV antibiotics. I wanted Brad to edit a piece that I had written for the CF Lifestyle Foundation. And because I apparently, I had looked at the messages recently, and apparently what was going on was that I was going to use that for a job application, whatever I was writing. And the next thing I knew, Brad was offering me a job.
Right, right. And it all worked out. Yeah.
And it all worked out. And then it really did. Like, I just, like, you know, all of my passions in terms of being able to speak for yourself and being or advocate for yourself in medical context, or being able to tell your story, to talk about mental health, and to give a voice to people in Latin America and or worldwide with CF, it all culminated into one position, which is my position today. And I, not only do I do it for CF, you know, I work with all sorts of rare diseases, and I could have never imagined that.
Well, no, and that leads perfectly to the next question. I mean, and I just want to say, like, it's really interesting that, you know, you were really active in advocacy from a young age, because, like, one of the things I, you know, I've written about and talked about plenty of times is, like, I've always been a part of the SMA community, but, like, you know, going to conferences and stuff, but I don't think I really took a, like, proactive role until later in life. And, you know, I mean, I was going to, like, MDA fundraisers and whatnot when I was a kid, but those were more just because, like, my parents did all the work and I was just kind of there, you know? And, and it's really interesting how that, like, and, you know, some people in rare disease communities have that kind of advocacy passion really early on, and it manifests over time. So it's really cool to see that. Leading into that. So yes. Yeah, so you met, you know, connected with Brad, who is the head of our columns division here at BioNews. And so, so talk about the work you do now as a social media manager. Like you said, you started out for the CF site, but then it expanded to other sites. And now you've gotten to connect with the SMA community.
So my title is actually community manager.
Right.
That's my actual, like, title. And I connected with Brad that one summer in 2018 because I was looking for a job, and he gave me, I had no idea what CF News Today was anyways. Like, I had no idea what I was doing. So it started off as part-time as the community manager for CF News Today. And so what that meant was working with the CF community through social media and through the lens of CF News Today. So promoting whatever was going on with our site, our main site, CF News Today, and kind of putting it out there, but also kind of giving a voice to the handle CF News Today, you know, whether that was on Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram. And I was trained by Brad, and you know, there wasn't a whole lot. I had a lot of wiggle room, and I ran with it. And it was kind of crazy because, you know, I kind of mentioned it earlier. I really love people's stories. I love hearing people tell their own stories, their own narrative, and their own voice. And so that's what I was thinking when I started managing and on the social media that we have, but particularly the Instagram account. And so I came up with this initiative called Women Crush Wednesday. I don't know where it came from. I don't know what compelled me to do it. But
Woman Crush Wednesday and Man Crush Monday. It's a
Nice. Well, it started off with Women Crush Wednesday first, and then, like, a Monday. Okay, I was like, I guess I should do both. And I asked one of my best friends at CF. You know, she was like my pilot. She
sure.
See if it would work or not.
Sure.
I said, hey, can you write me three things that are important to your story with CF? And can you give me a picture that you like? And she was like, yeah, sure. And I had no idea how it was going to do on the CF Instagram. Got a lot of, like, good reciprocation. Like, people really enjoyed that. And people actually asked me if they could be Women Crush Wednesday. And I was really surprised. And so that went on for, like, a couple of months. And I added the Man Crush Monday. It got the attention of our CEO, Chris, and I think the rest of our, because I don't think anybody knew who I was or what I was doing. And then I was coming up with this campaign on Instagram, and they were like, hey, we really like what you're doing. Would you be interested in doing that for our other sites, or, like, another rare disease site? And I said, at first I said, I don't think I can, because, like, I don't think it can be I can speak for people with other diseases.
Sure.
And I was really nervous about that, but I agreed to do it for the SMA site, the spinal muscular atrophy site. And I was really nervous and I didn't know what I was doing. And I felt like it wasn't appropriate for me to be there.
Right. It's like running a thing where
you're not able to answer all the questions
and everything.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
I feel like it wasn't my space, but I went ahead and did it. And wild for me to see, to talk to and collaborate. And in a lot of ways, I see this as collaboration. It is collaborations with other people in different communities and to bond with people outside of the CF community over, you know, I mean, like our conversations, Kevin, I mean, we easily click because we have a lot of shared experiences. And although you may not be coughing up blood like I have, but you have been in the hospital, you have been the patient many times. And I think that underlying commonality gives room for growth, for friendship and growth.
Yeah.
And I was seeing that with the SMA community, and I was seeing it, you know, and I was in awe. And I started developing, like, one of my really good friends is through the SMA channel, Mylin, and she lives in Miami, you know?
Yeah.
So it was kind of, it was crazy, like, to see that happening and unfolding in SMA. And I don't have SMA. You know, I do get questions about SMA, like things very specific to SMA. And, you know, when I don't have an answer, I have the perfect resources. Like, you know, I have, you know, our team, but I'm creating these friendships. You know, I never anticipated creating friendships, you know, because I've been managing the SMA, especially the Instagram account. It just baffles my mind that I know what Spinraza is, or I know what Risdiplam is, or I know that these are some of the most expensive medications. It's just wild to be immersed in a community that's outside of the CF community.
Well, and I remember one conversation we had one time where you were surprised to learn that people in the SMA community use the Vest machine, just like which was originally developed for CF, and then SMA kind of adopted it later. So it's really fascinating to see the kind of like the overlap
is
in scenarios like that.
Right. And I started noticing, you know, I started with the SMA, or I started with CF, and then I got SMA, and then that expanded to 10 different rare disease communities. And I finally am kind of coming to the realization that, okay, it's not even physically possible for us to have that much variation, because there's only one human body. The human body can only have so many variations, like so many things mess up. So even though they're not going to be the same exact symptoms, there's going to inevitably be so much overlap between our experiences. And that, I think, is such a beautiful space to create friendship and to grow, to learn from another person, and to feel connected to another human being. I think, and that's ultimately what I'm learning through this experience as the community manager of these different rare disease social media pages, is that there is so much room for connection between people with rare diseases. And I'm even going to say that outside of people who have rare diseases, I think we have this underlying commonality of having a human body, of being human and living the experience of being human. You know, we all enjoy laughing. We all enjoy talking and being heard and being listened to and sharing our voice. You know, and we can do that through, you know, obviously social media is where how I do it, but you know, you can be kind. That's another lesson I've learned, is that you can just be kind and spark so much room for caring and connection just through being a little bit vulnerable. And people with rare diseases have to be vulnerable. We don't really quite have a choice, but I carry that wherever I go, that aspect of vulnerability. And I think, you know, it connects us rather than distances us.
Yeah. No, that's great. And I mean, heck, that's why this podcast exists. And I want to like highlight different stories from people in the SMA community. And I think it's really cool what you said about, you know, how we're united through different rare diseases. And on that note, so we are running short on time, but, you know, I mentioned earlier that later this month, February 29th, is internationally recognized as Rare Disease Day. And this is a day to recognize a wide range of rare diseases and the people who live with them. So can you give us just a brief overview of the project we're doing here at SMA News Today and other sites as well at BioNews for this event?
Yeah, so on our social media for BioNews, which listeners are going to know it as SMA News Today or CF News Today, et cetera, and et cetera, we are doing a campaign called hashtag What Makes Me Rare. And so for, you know, for example, for CF, it would be hashtag What Makes Me Rare CF, or for SMA, it would be hashtag What Makes Me Rare SMA. And we're asking people to use that hashtag and that kind of prompt to either film a video of themselves filling in that blank, you know, what makes me rare, or writing a little bit, writing something about what makes them rare with whatever rare disease they may have, you know?
Sure.
So we're getting all of these contributions compiled, and I really emphasize the videos because at the end of the month, we're going to take all of the videos that we have gotten. And on Rare Disease Day, which is February 29th, we are going to do a huge video compilation of people's contributions, and it's really exciting. And what really makes me happy about it is just people get to use their actual voices to say, you know, this is what I have, and this is why it makes me rare. And it doesn't necessarily have to be the fact that you do have a rare disease. Whatever you feel compelled to say, that makes you rare. That makes you rare.
Makes you rare. Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
No, and it's a really cool initiative. And it's something we planned here with both with all the social media team and my department and everything. And yeah, for our listeners out there, we'd love for you to participate. This is going to be a really cool thing. So if you just head over to the SMA News Today Instagram page or to the forums, you know, you can find more info about it. But yeah, this will be a really cool opportunity for those of you who want to share your stories and insight. And we're always, like Louisa said, we're always doing things like this on our social media and multimedia and forums and all of that. So, you know, we really want to highlight all kinds of stories. So that's really cool.
Just send it to, if you want to contribute to our rare disease campaign, What Makes Me Rare, send us an email at socialmedia@bionewsservices.com. Or if you're following us on Instagram, send us a message through Instagram, or on Facebook, send us a DM. Or if you...
any of those platforms work great. Yeah, no, yeah. We'll definitely make sure, you know, your voice can be heard if you want it. So we would love for anyone, you know, whether you're someone with SMA, a parent or caregiver or whatever, or, you know, in one of the other rare disease communities that we have pages for as well, you know, we would love to hear your story. So it's going to be really cool.
Just give us a shout, send us an email or a DM on one of our channels.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Well, Louisa, I want to thank you so much for coming on today. This was really great. And I think it's a really cool way to kind of highlight some of the different communities we have here at our company. And just the ways, you know, like you talked about, that our communities intersect and overlap and we can have shared experiences, you know?
Yeah. It was really great being on here. Thank you, Kevin.
Absolutely. Well, and other than the SMA, all the Instagram pages, is there anywhere else listeners out there can connect with you?
So we have all of our Instagram pages for ALS, pulmonary fibrosis, pulmonary hypertension, SMA, CF, Friedreich's ataxia. I can't remember all of them.
Yeah, we've got a lot, but
we've got a lot. But if you want to get in contact and you have a rare disease and you don't find us, just send me an email at socialmedia@bionewsservices.com.
That's great. Well, again, Louisa, thanks so much. This was great. And yeah, we look forward to more collaborations like this in the future. So
yay. Thank you.
Absolutely. And for our listeners out there, you can hear more stories like this by subscribing to the SMA News Today podcast. You can also connect with us directly on our forums and our Instagram page and follow our main website at www.smanewstoday.com for the latest SMA news and perspectives. I'm your host, Kevin Schaefer. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time. Take care.
Bye. Thank you.
The information in our flash briefings and podcast are provided for informational and educational purposes only. Be sure to tune in daily to SMA News Today for the latest news and perspectives regarding the disease. All of our podcast and flash briefings can be found on our website at www.smanewstoday.com. You can also find our podcast and flash briefings on SoundCloud, Spotify, and iTunes. and be sure to follow us on our Instagram and Facebook page as well. I'm Michael Morale, Senior Director of Multichannel Content for SMA News Today.